Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante. He is Zach Sako. Zach, a much easier conversation this week than it was a week ago.
Yeah, it helps when you go up 28-0 at half and never look back after that. And that's not a bad team. Penn State made Washington look bad, but that is not a bad team.
No, Washington has not. Now, Washington seems to be exhibit A when you talk about that Big Ten on the road, traveling a couple time zones. Washington is winless on the road. So that's a factor in all this. But I'm with you. They are not a bad team. No. It's a pretty respectable defense. Offensively, there's some weapons, a good running back. I think it's a decent quarterback. He has a couple decent weapons at wide receiver. But Penn State, I think it is, you tell me, best half of the season, that first half against Washington, 28-0?
Yeah, easily. When you look at all the other contests, I mean, even against Kent State, there was at least a little bit of a lag for Penn State to get going. And then right out of the gate, they didn't waste any time. It felt like they were calling the best plays available that they had. And Washington had no answer. I mean, sure, Washington had its first opening drive that just kind of kept going when it should have stopped. But, I mean, Penn State, 28-0. That would have been nice against, because there are plenty other times. They 20-6 down at half against USC. And it feels like even though they lost the Ohio State game, right, they jumped out to a 10-0 lead. So the slow starts aren't really as much of an issue. I know a loss is a loss, so there's no moral victories. However, Penn State is getting better in terms of starting on the right foot.
Yes, I think that whole starting slow narrative can be put to rest. As you pointed out, against Ohio State, Penn State scores on their first possession. They get the pick six, get a 10-point lead. And in this game, and it's interesting, Zach, and I think it's kind of a little bit of losing the forest for the trees a lot of time when you watch the game. And I really don't pick this up to the next day when I start to look at the stat sheet. I'm always interested in the drive stat sheet. And when you look at this for Penn State, those first four possessions, touchdown, 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 touchdown. Doesn't get better than that. But also part of this is the number of plays. 9 plays, 14 plays, 8 plays, 9 plays. These were not fluke possessions. They were dominating possessions, marching down the field very methodically, very precise. Drew Aller really on his game. To me, that makes it even the more impressive.
Well, and I can't help but wonder, where were these plays against Ohio State? And it's not the rhythm, because the matchup obviously helps. Penn State's better than Washington. Penn State's offensive line had as good of a day, as good of a game as I can remember. They, you know, played okay. But this game was okay, domination across the board, no sacks. The ground game had over 250 yards. Drew Aller was able to go through his progressions. And yes, an elite team like Ohio State is going to make anybody's day more difficult. Point being that Andy Kotelnicki felt like he was using plays that you didn't need against Washington. You needed them against Ohio State. Where is the Superman direct snap to Tyler Warren diving over the goal line? Not once, but twice. You broke out the Bo Prabula package inside of the 10 early on, or inside of the red zone early on, and it's score. And that's what they scored the first touchdown with. So where was that in the biggest, most consequential game of the season?
Zach, I'm with you, and you're just beating me to the punch. Everything I'm talking about was leading up to that conversation, because everything fans were saying about that drive against Ohio State when they were inside the 10, you know, at the 4 or 3 yard line starting their drive, they did all of that this week against Washington.
Yeah.
They had Tyler Warren, that quarterback. They had Bo Prabhul, that quarterback. They ran wide. They threw the ball prior to fourth down. And the only explanation I could have for it is they get tight. And maybe that's not fair. I don't want to use the word tight. But I think they just got so conservative. And I'll throw one more thing in, and I'd like to get your take on it. Part of that conservative was watching Drew Aller throw some of those passes against Washington. Mm-hmm. He showed real arm talent. It wasn't like the receivers had a lot of separation. He was just able to thread the needle 15, 20 yards down the field. And it just felt like they weren't even looking to have that kind of pass against Ohio State. And I know, better DBs there. But you got a unique arm talent at quarterback. So I think there's multiple areas, not just on the goal line, where it felt like they were just too conservative against Ohio State.
And I also think that's just how good, how great, how elite Ohio State is, that they take those, they can take those gimmicky plays away. So I felt like there wasn't enough initiative for Penn State to try those plays against Ohio State. I also think that Ohio State did do a good job in terms of preparing for what Penn State was going to try and throw at them, because they did stop them twice inside of the 5-yard line. That's got to count for something. I don't think that's luck. I think that's Penn State's failure to execute. I think that's also a testament to just how good Ohio State is in the front seven. Washington, from a talent standpoint, in the secondary is pretty comparable to Ohio State, actually. The thing is, Ohio State's just more of a complete defense. Washington doesn't have a complete defense. That front seven of the 3-4 is not good. Penn State's offensive line is better, and they performed as such. But their secondary, if you put Ohio State's if you combined Ohio State's front seven, that defensive line and that group of linebackers, with Washington's secondary, that would be a pretty good all-around defense there. So Washington, I think, still did a good job in terms of its coverage. They also lost that one player, Dixon, to targeting. That is their second best. That's their best defensive back. That's their second best overall player as a whole on the defense. And that was early in the game, too. So that was pretty deflating for a Washington team that, okay, really doesn't have much to play for here except pride and maybe spoil Penn State season, where Penn State has everything in front of them. So at the end of the day, all those things can be true at the same time. Penn State didn't do enough of those kinds of plays to punch it in when they needed it. And at the end of the day, Ohio State did turn them away. So it's got to count for something on both sides.
All right. You mentioned it, the targeting call. And I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the calls in this game. Let's start with the targeting call. By the letter of the law, it was targeting.
I mean, I don't like the rule, but right.
Yeah. I was just going to, I had several people on the Penn State side say, you know what, that was, you know, a form tackle that had the helmet contact, mm-hmm. you know, it was, and maybe your answer is the right one, Zach. It's just not a great rule.
No, I think the rule is wrong, is bad. I don't like that. I understand the consequence of it because they're trying to prioritize player safety. However, I don't think that you should eject an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old player from the entirety of a game, because football is so, it's so bang bang, it's so quick. So if an offensive player is going low, and as a defender, if you don't happen to go lower, you're probably going to get called for targeting. So what it really is, it scrutinizes defensive play and not offensive play, because we see a good amount of times where the offensive player lowers the head, leads with the crown, and the defensive player is almost defenseless in some sort of sense when it's like that kind of collision. So I think it's just too difficult to play defense at points in time. I understand maybe, okay, how about he's removed for the remainder of the quarter or a full quarter? I don't think the whole game is a little ridiculous.
I do too. And I think that there could even be, and I'm not even sure if it's the same way in basketball anymore, you know, the flagrant one, flagrant two. And maybe the problem with that is it depends on discretion of the officials, and you like to take that out as much as possible. But I think when that helmet to helmet happens just in the course of normal play, hey, that's not a big deal. I think we all know when we see it, when a player is looking to punish the offensive player with the crown of his helmet. And they're very distinctly different, in my opinion. And what I think the guy there was looking to make a good football tackle play, and there just happened to be that kind of contact. So I'm with you on that also. In going down the calls path, the officiating, the other big call was the, is it a reception and fumble or is it an incompletion? And what makes this call more interesting is we had almost identical a week ago against Ohio State, and it was called exactly the opposite way, Zach.
Yeah, and when you get different refereeing crews, you're going to have different interpretations, but that's the idea of having a rule book and a playbook. Look, I still stand by the fact that Quinshon Judkins of Ohio State secured the football with two hands. He made the catch, and then on the transfer, he bobbled it. So I don't when he's trying to so he caught the football, had it securely in two hands, and then when he tried to secure it underneath his armpit, that's where the fumble occurred. Okay, so he made the reception, but Ohio State fans will tried to gaslight me, pointing that out, saying that's not it, you don't know football. That's not a fumble. He made the catch, and then in transferring it moved. So, and he made a football move. He's turning and he's bracing for a hit. That's a football move. So I agree that it is a fumble across the board. Tyler Warren's is a fumble. And Quinshon Judkins is a fumble. You catch it, you secure it with two hands, then you turn to make a football move. That's a fumble. Okay? So it I but I understand the issue. It's either a fumble or both of them are incompletions. You got to make a choice because they were extremely similar. And I agree with the fact that they're both turnovers, even though they weren't called that way.
All right. I believe I agree with you, Zach, and we don't have enough time to really finish up this conversation. So after the break, I want to give you my take on it. And but I think the word I'm going to use is consistency. It is what we're looking for. We'll pick up this conversation though right after this break. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Halt Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. I'm Jim Galante. He is Zach Seiko. Zach, tell our listeners where they can find your podcast.
Jim, I appreciate that. So I'm the host of Locked On Nittany Lions. It is a daily Penn State podcast, and that includes football, men's basketball, wrestling, 30 minutes every day on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts, plus interviews, live shows, live reactions throughout the week as bonus content as well. So it's all intensive on the Penn State front.
In a couple of weeks, we are going to start talking Penn State hoops, my friend. Count on it.
They're off to a very good start.
Yes, I love that, putting up 100 points, and they just had their best recruit, highest ranked recruit coming in also, Zach. So some good stuff going on with Penn State hoops. All right, when we finished up quarter number one, Zach, we were talking about completion, fumble, incompletion, back-to-back weeks where it was similar. You brought up the point that you thought they were both catches and fumbles. I agree with you. And I think what could really support that argument is if that happened as they were going over the goal line, they're probably calling it a touchdown.
Yeah, interestingly enough, that would be the case. Well, don't have those same referees review the Jesse James play, because I think that would really have their heads spin, the one against the Patriots, right? And then there's that connection to Penn State too. So yeah, over the goal line, the second, but that's the difference though, okay? So you're in the field of play versus the second you cross the goal line with the nose of the football, it's ruled a touchdown and the play is over. Okay, but it's different when you're in the field of play and you still have yards to gain. So that's really the only difference there. But I understand your point. I just say call it a fumble. Anyway, if you have two hands securely on the football, what you do with it afterwards, if you juggle it, that's on you. You caught it. You tried to secure it. You made a football move and you fumbled it. That's a fumble.
I'm with you. My point about the touchdown is, it can't be a touchdown unless you catch the ball. Mm-hmm. So if that would be ruled the touchdown in that scenario, that means mm-hmm. you caught the ball.
Yeah.
So, and the other, and the last point I'll make on this, Zach, is the inconsistency. You would think the conference has that kind of play, has that kind of ruling like they did a week ago. I would think they would come out to their officiating crews and say, look, here's the mm-hmm. film of what happened. And this is an incompletion for this reason. Now, I think they should come out to the public also and really define. So, yeah, there is a full definition of the catch. It should not be inconsistent between a different officiating crew. So, anyway, let's move on from that. I want to talk about Drew Aller a little bit more.
Sure.
This, to me, I don't want to call it his best game. Because I know he had several other good ones, but when you start completing over 70% of the passes, and some of those, as I said earlier, he's threading the needle. That's a big time arm that we saw there, Zach.
I definitely won't. I will say this was one of his better games, but it wasn't close to his best game. Honestly, I saw more out of him against USC, where he happened to throw three interceptions, than I did against Washington, because I thought at times his decision-making was a little questionable. Tyler Warren would get open. Drew Aller's biggest issue is sometimes going through his reads a little too quickly or moving off of a player just at a split second extra, and you would find that it's that hesitation that, okay, he's not open, I got to move on. If you give him, and I've never been a college or professional quarterback, obviously, so I don't want to harp on Drew too much. It's a small issue because it doesn't jeopardize them. But I saw one, two, three, you know, a few times there where I'm like, you know, Drew threw it away or tried to go to the check down. Oh, Tyler Warren's open. Oh, Trey Wallace is open. And you would have had 25, if not maybe more yards on those plays. So it didn't cost them anything. It didn't hurt them in any regard. But there's still those little decision-making errors that I'm just like, okay, the only way he's going to fix that is through time and practice and in-game situations. It's not that it's not fixable, but I still see it show up one too many times. Whereas against USC, again, even though he threw multiple interceptions, I felt like his decision-making, his confidence, the way he was leading the offense up and down the field was a lot more efficient, and you had more explosive plays tied to it. I still feel like Drew Aller is sometimes a little overprotective with the football, but honestly, because of where this defense is, that is a good thing. Drew Aller is being coached that way, like, hey, you don't need to put the football in harm's way. We don't need it all back in one play. So if you can survive, if it's not there, if you don't like it, just play to live another down. It is not worth giving the other offense, the other team, momentum and a short field because you make an egregious error. So I guess in a sense, I do like that Drew Aller is prone to not making the big mistake in comparison to the small mistake by just throwing it to the check down or throwing it away, even though he might have missed a 30-yard play opportunity when they really don't need it.
Well, you make some really good points, but I'll also point out, Zach, what I find interesting is that it almost feels like they try to have those very methodical drives down the field. Mm-hmm. But if they ever have to put the ball in the game in Drew Aller's hands, it feels like he's even better. You brought up the USC game. They're down a couple touchdowns, hey, Drew, you got to march us down the field. And it's exactly. amazing how quickly he could do that. And I earlier I pointed out four consecutive touchdowns with play nine plays, 14 plays, eight plays, nine plays. But I think what's even more instructive, Zach, is the time of possession in those drives. The first three were 4 minutes, 6.5 minutes, 4 minutes. But then at the end of the half, even though it was nine plays, minute and a half. And how often have we seen that, like at the end of half, when they have to put it in his hands, we see, I think the decision-making, to your point, becomes more, he knows he's got a time limit. He's not just afraid of, he's avoiding mistakes. He's actually trying to get the ball down the field quickly, and he's pretty effective at it.
Well, and that's what I like about this offense is that they are built to win in a variety of ways. They can run the ball 50 times. They can throw the ball 50 times. They can go up-tempo. They can go West Coast, quick, short pass. And they can win based on what the defense is giving you. Again, that Ohio State game was really, really close. Penn State punches it in at the end of the first half, and then they don't even need to score a touchdown that second time they get to the goal line. They can kick a field goal and win hypothetically 23-20. It's the fact that a year ago under Mike Yurcich, aside from the explosive plays, Penn State played offense in a phone booth. There were only so many ways that they could move the football up and down the field, and then they would not sustain drives. Andy Kotelnicki got them to the goal line. The players didn't execute. That's what it came down to. So Andy Kotelnicki has been able to get this offense to move up and down the field almost at will, except for Ohio State, because they didn't do that. They didn't move the, up and down the football. But they were able to sustain drives throughout that game. They've been able to move up and down the football field against other opponents, whereas routinely, more often than not, a Mike Yurcich offense would stall at the 50-yard line. They'd be forced to consider a fourth and two on their own side of the field. And you're just not seeing that with an Andy Kotelnicki offense. Now, granted, Drew Aller's in another year of starting. Katron Allen and Nicholas Singleton might not be available. We'll see. But those two guys are more experienced, and they are more talented. Wide receivers are relatively the same, and you have a superstar player in Tyler Warren. Mike Yurcich is worked with the same group of players, even though you could make the argument, well, they are technically better because they're all a little more experienced here. But that's kind of the difference, is that Andy Kotelnicki is helping them move down the football field, whereas Mike Yurcich got them to the 50 or the 40 on the opponent's side of the football field, and then they would have to punt.
That's a good point. I'm glad you brought up Nick Singleton, who didn't play, I think, just a couple plays in the second half before being taken out. It's unfortunate because the last several games, he didn't look the same, didn't look quite as explosive. This mm-hmm. game, though, it seemed like we had the old Nick Singleton back.
Yeah, that certainly seemed like the case. But we only saw seven carries out of him, and I think he had a couple of receptions. I don't. Let me see if I can get the stats in front of me just to get that correct.
Have it in front of me.
Seven carries and three receptions. So he had yes. 10 touches. I've already given my opinion about Singleton as far as how Penn State should handle him. It is a delicate situation because they don't want to burn Quentin Martin and Corey Smith's red shirt. They have to be careful with Martin. They can actually play Corey Smith down the stretch of the end of the season and not worry about his eligibility. But you only have Katron Allen. You lost Cam Wallace. He's out indefinitely. We don't know what is technically wrong with him, but we know that he's out indefinitely and probably won't be back for the season. You need Singleton for the playoffs. You don't need Singleton for Purdue. You don't need him for Minnesota. You don't need him against Maryland. You can win those three games convincingly without him. So if you need a head start, hopefully it's not severe. Hopefully it is not extremely serious. But if you can rest him and you need that extended period to late December, do it now. Get him all of November, get him a full 6-7 weeks, and get him rested for that home playoff game, because that's where Penn State is trending. They will either be the 5 or the 6 seed once they finish 11-1.
Good point there, but leads me to that was our first real look at Corey Smith. I know he had that big run, but your overview, your takeaway from watching him for the first time.
He's as good as advertised. Penn State and James Franklin have said that we like both Quentin Martin and Corey Smith, and that's why we are working to redshirt them to maximize their eligibility. So it's not just the Quentin Martin show. That's going to be your next 1-2 punch with, and don't forget about Cam Wallace in the future, but right now, Quentin Martin and Corey Smith add a dynamic, and you could use all three of those running backs. Corey Smith and Quentin Martin are capable pass catchers. So who's to say you can't have all three of them on the field and line one of them up in the slot? They're versatile.
And Quentin Martin, he's been out. He was nicked up, although I believe he was available.
He suited up. Yeah, he was available.
He was available. How many games has he played? I'm just thinking two. In redshirt terms. So
two. So
he still has two left for regular season, and Corey Smith has three, right? He has three, games eligible to play through the rest. And I think they're fortunate with Nick Singleton. Purdue glorified scrimmage, so there should be no issue having Nick Singleton. I'm not, you know, Minnesota on the road, they've been a little up and down. You probably don't need Nick Singleton, but I think if he's ready to play, they'll probably play him.
Yeah, keep him up to game speed, but definitely protect him for the future because, like I said, you can win these final three games without him.
You definitely can, and I like your mentioning. Yeah, if they win out, and they should, that's a home playoff game.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm with you. That will turn into, I'm thinking more likely a number six seed, but that's a conversation for another time, Zach. I appreciate your time. Thank you all. But stick with us. We've got Sean Gold coming in, and he's going to make his picks for this coming week. Stay tuned. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hulk Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number three. I'm Jim Galante, and with me is Sean Gold from Sean's Take. Sean, finally, a great week for both of us last week.
We broke through. It had been a couple weeks. It feels good. We're back on track now. You know, let's keep it like this now moving forward.
It's a harbinger of things to come. I sense a hot streak, Sean. That's the way I'm looking at it.
I'm all for that happening. I love that.
Me too. Let's take a look. Let's revel in it for a while. Let's take a look at last week's games. Let's take a look at our picks and see how we did. I'm going to start with one that I won, and this was Florida at Texas, 21.5 point spread. And what was interesting is this got ugly really early, and I texted you when it was halftime, I believe, at Texas. Texas was up big, and my line to you was, I hope we took Texas. That one was my pick. You had Florida.
Yeah, that was, you know, I thought Florida defense, you could kind of stay in the game against the big spread, but 35-0 at halftime, a really good performance that Texas definitely needed to get their mojo back. So, you know, Texas reminded us that they're still a national championship contender despite that loss a couple weeks ago. And Florida also reminded us that, you know, they're not that great of a program this year.
And, you know, it's the Southeast Conference, and we'll hit – a couple more Southeast Conference games from last week. In fact, let's hit all of those first. You just don't know what team you're going to get from week to week. You could have an Alabama beating Georgia one week and losing to Vanderbilt the next. You could have someone losing to Arkansas. And it just it's crazy. And speaking of which, the next one was Georgia at Ole Miss, and Ole Miss was a 2.5-point underdog. You and I both took Georgia, and to be honest with you, I felt pretty good about that pick. I thought that spread was low. I thought Georgia's just a much better team. And it wasn't even really close.
No, it wasn't. And this was also my most confident pick of the week. How is Georgia and Kirby Smart going to drop their second game of the season? They lose to Alabama. That's about the only team in the country that Georgia ever loses to. I did not think Ole Miss was a real threat. And Ole Miss dominated that game for four quarters. Georgia never looked like they had a shot in this game. Their first drive was the only positive drive of that entire game for Georgia. And after that, it was just downhill from there. So I'm really shocked about Georgia. The offense is a major concern for me right now. I thought you should have been able to put up some points against Ole Miss.
And you mentioned their loss to Alabama. And I remember that game and watching it. Alabama raced out to the huge lead quickly. And then Georgia, it's like they flipped the switch, came all the way back. I believe actually took the lead before Alabama had the late score, wonderful play, to win the game. So I thought, with Georgia, I don't even ding them with a full loss. It was like, okay, for half that game. But here we saw them. I really didn't see this coming against Ole Miss. You and I, again, that's not a game that I will look at and say, boy, I should have known to take Ole Miss. No, I felt good about it, and I feel like the next 10 times they play like that, Georgia would win 8 out of 10 times. So don't regret that pick, even though it was a loss. Let's stay in the Southeast Conference just to kind of wrap up those games. And that was Alabama at LSU. This game, to me, was a bit of a toss-up. Neither team could afford to lose this game. And it was home at LSU. You gave all the stats. Brian Kelly hasn't lost at night at home at LSU. I thought that home field, home cooking would be the difference. I took LSU. You were smarter than me. You had Alabama.
Look, I thought Alabama was going to win this game just because I think they're a better program, but I was not expecting this game to be a 42-13 blowout in Death Valley. That's a hard place to play, and especially at night. Like we talked about it, Brian Kelly was so incredibly good at home, so incredibly good at home at night games, and Alabama came in 14-3 in the first quarter and never looked back. I was shocked that this was a blowout like it was. I picked Alabama to win this one and cover, but not like this.
It was a surprise. And again, that whole, you know, who is Alabama? And Sean, in looking at the Southeast Conference as a whole, I know I went into this season thinking, hey, this is going to be the typical Southeast Conference. I know Alabama had the big change in coaches. Nick Saban is out. Kellen DeBoer is in. I thought Alabama and Georgia would be the sure thing, sure fire. They both have two losses, which, how many years ago do we have to go back before we could see both those programs having two losses at this point in the season?
It is really incredible because, yeah, we always thought that there were two pillars in the SEC that were above the rest. And then we knew, you know, Tennessee would be good. We knew Texas would be good, but this is crazy. And you know what? It's really entertaining, though, as well, to see some of these teams going down and a lot of shakeups going on in the SEC finally.
It is. And I don't know if you've seen any of the setup. If you just take a look at the standings in the Southeast Conference, you'll know what I'm talking about, the chaos that is going on there. I saw someone do a write-up where it only took like one considerable upset, and it's possible to have like a six-way tie with everybody with two losses.
Yeah, it's going to – I mean, I haven't pulled up Tennessee – A&M, Texas, Georgia, Ole Miss, and then Alabama at six. For how good of a team this Alabama team is in conference, it is a major shakeup right now.
And I don't know, did you say Georgia in that group? I'm not even sure if you included them.
Georgia is at four right now, 5-2 in conference play, but they got a big game coming up this weekend too, and that could make or break their season right now, which we've already said that a couple times about Georgia so far this year.
that is a huge game, and that's going to be on our list of games for this coming week. All right, let's go to the non-Southeast Conference games. Michigan at Indiana. This was one of those games that Michigan is not good this year. This is not our typical Michigan team. In fact, with this loss, I think they're at 500 now. But it was a 14-point spread. Indiana favored over Michigan. Michigan gave them a game. It was very competitive. I think the final was 20-15. You and I both had Michigan. We both felt it would be kept close enough, closer than 14. I'm not sure we thought it would be as close as it was, but hey, that was good enough for a win for both of us.
It definitely was. And I'm really proud of this pick for us because everything Saturday morning was saying Indiana, Indiana, Indiana. And we saw through that. It is, you know, people are saying Michigan's season is over. At a program like Michigan, where you've had so much stability, your season's never over. You're always going to be motivated to play for something. You're motivated to play for that name on your helmet right there. Being at Michigan means a lot. And these players did not want to go out and get blown out by Indiana, who they've consistently beaten time in and time again.
And I think it's also more than just the pride in Michigan. It's the, you know what, if you go out, if this were against Purdue, I'm sure they would win, but it has no meaning. Knocking off an undefeated team is their opportunity to do something significant. So that's what I liked about Michigan. Yes, you used the word proud of the pick. I'm with you. I'm proud of that pick also. I think we both did well there. Next one up, you know we love us some Colorado Buffaloes. And they were at Texas Tech. I was a little surprised on that spread. It was only Colorado favored by 3.5 points. The Buffaloes continue to be good to us.
They do. Another pick. If I'm proud of Michigan pick, you know I'm proud of our Colorado pick, because also every single thing on Saturday morning, every metric was saying Texas Tech is going to pull off the upset, is going to knock off Colorado. And as we talked about almost every week with Colorado, you've got the two best players on the field in Shador Sanders and Travis Hunter. And then you really have the three best, because Travis Hunter is the best player on defense as well. That showed through majorly in the second half when Colorado's offense just took off. And we're seeing how much better their defense is improving this season compared to last season. It's a completely different unit.
It really is. It's a different team. I've been riding the Colorado wave for a while here. What's interesting, Sean, with some of these picks is we have some of the same teams. Of course, you know, we're picking games that are at the top of the hill, the better teams and the better, more interesting games. But it's kind of going to be a similar conversation. A week ago, yeah, it was Georgia at Ole Miss, two really good teams. Could Georgia come through with that? We're going to have that exact same discussion in the fourth quarter with Georgia versus Tennessee, and we're also going to have this same conversation with Colorado against Utah. I think there's going to be a lot of people that think Utah might be able to keep this one close. So, like I said, it's going to be interesting, similar conversations going forward. All right, our last game last week, of course, we have to have the Nittany Lions. Washington, not good on the road, Sean. They had to travel to Penn State. They are winless on the road coming into Penn State. And I know Penn State hasn't necessarily been blowing people out. But we both took the Nittany Lions. I think it was a combination of a bounce back for Penn State and Washington on the road, which fueled my pick of the Nittany Lions.
You nailed it right there, because I was worried. Washington's been a team. We saw what they did to USC. They can beat good teams, and I was really scared that that might be what Penn State would fall into. But the whiteout, traveling across the country, that was enough for me to go with the Nittany Lions, and I'm really happy about how they played in this game, especially in the first half. 28 points in the first half, that's not something we've seen from Penn State in a while. So that was really refreshing to see their offense put together drives and end in touchdowns, which they haven't done in recent weeks. So you got to love what you saw from Penn State.
Definitely. And you look at it with the raw number of 28 points in the first half, which is really nice. I look at it as four drives, four touchdowns. And it wasn't, you know, on a pick six. It wasn't on a 90-yard run or pass play. They were drives. They drove the ball down the field consistently four times in a row. All right, Sean, that's it for quarter number three. When we come back, our Pulp Daddy picks for this coming week. Stay tuned for that. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.
Welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show, brought to you by Hulk Daddy Hazy IPA, award-winning beer by Greater Good Brewing, built by Penn Staters for PA. Look for the green can at your local retailer.
Hello and welcome back to the Keystone Kickoff Show. It's quarter number four. I'm Jim Galante. He is Sean Gold from Sean's Take. And it's time for our Pulp Daddy Picks of the Week, Sean. We got a six-pack of games before us. Are you ready to roll?
I'm ready. Pulp Daddy, let's get it.
All right. We are both coming off 4-2 weeks against the spread. Tremendous. That made us a combined 8-4. I'll take that any week of the year. And we got some fascinating games. And I think even more, some fascinating spreads this week, Sean. So I'm going to be interested not just on your picks for these games, but your thoughts on where this spread ended up. We've got Utah at Colorado. Colorado has been a favorite of ours. They've been playing well. I know you like the Colorado Buffaloes. I don't necessarily like them as a team, but I like how good they've been to me. Colorado is hosting Utah, and Colorado, a 10-point favorite. It was interesting. A week ago, they were merely a 3.5-point favorite at Texas Tech. This time, a 10-point favorite. But they're playing against the Utah team. I'm not sure if it's their defense is so good or just their style of play. Their punter is very good. They don't give up a lot of points. They don't score a lot, but they don't give up a lot here, Sean.
Yeah, it's a really interesting game because we know how good Utah's defense is, but we know how good Colorado's offense is, and I believe that Colorado's going to be able to score. So my main question is, how much can Utah score in this game? And we all know I love Colorado, but 10 points against this Utah team is a little worrisome for me. I think it's going to be a close game. Utah really probably should have beaten BYU last week. So Utah is one of those teams who can ruin your season. That's their sole motivation going into Colorado this week. I think Colorado should win this game, but I got to go with plus 10 for Utah against the spread.
You know what? That pretty much explains why I have the Utes also. Colorado's been riding this wave, and it feels like every time you start to ride that wave, it eventually crashes, Sean. And that's what I picture for this one for Colorado. I'm going with Utah also. Although losing to BYU a week ago and now going on the road, you wonder a little bit if there's a hangover for Utah. I don't think so. I think that same thing we talked about, being able to ruin another team's season, I think Utah would really like to do that to Colorado. I've got Utah also. All right, next up, a couple weeks ago, this looked like a really big game. Clemson at Pitt. Clemson with just one loss. Pitt undefeated. Well, that's kind of changed here. In the meantime, in the last couple weeks, Clemson has lost a game. Pitt has now lost two in a row. So Clemson at Pitt, it's a 10-point spread. Clemson, the 10-point favorite in this one, Sean.
You know, it's a very interesting game. Pitt's offense is struggling right now, and 10 points still seems like a big spread in this game when both teams have a lot of uncertainties. What I do really like, though, is that Clemson seemed to figure things out in the second half against Virginia Tech. I think we may see some of the great Clemson offensive possessions that we were seeing before their loss to Louisville in this game. So I don't love minus 10, but I'm going to take it because I think Clemson is just a better team. They're better coached, and they have an offense that I know can put up points when they're clicking, and I think they're going to be clicking in this game.
You know, Sean, sometimes there's teams that burst onto the scene, Pitt, you know, that undefeated. In the back of my head, I'm still thinking that's a fraud team. That they're not an undefeated team. Well, guess what? The last 2 weeks, I think that was reality. Striking Pitt. I think their bubble's been burst. I think Clemson still has something to play for. Hey, they could still win the ACC, be a playoff team. That's a very realistic outcome for Clemson. I'm going with Clemson in this one, and I'm actually feeling pretty good about this pick too. So words I may live to regret, but I think that may be my best bet of the week. I'm going with Clemson on that one. All right. Next up, it's our Nittany Lions. They are at Purdue. No other way to put it. Purdue is just a bad team. They're not just losing, they're losing badly. People are running up the score against them. Not a good team at all. It's a 28.5 point spread, but the Nittany Lions, they do not necessarily put up a lot of points. Now, part of it is, and I need to do an investigation, take a closer look at this, Sean, but it just feels like they have so few possessions because their possessions – Their time of possession is so long that last week I mentioned 4 touchdowns in the first half, 28 points. But to get there, they had to go 4 for 4, and they had to get the ball back with less than 2 minutes to go for that last drive to get up to 28 points. If Washington had had one more first down, Penn State probably would have had a total of 3 possessions in the first half. So that 28.5 points is a huge number.
That's what really worries me. And, you know, I don't know that there's necessarily a reason that Penn State needs to beat Purdue by 28.5 points. You can win this game and dominate this game and not cover that spread. But then again, I'm not exactly confident that Purdue's going to score at all in this game. You know, we've seen them get shut out against good teams. And Penn State is kind of measuring up their performance against Purdue against what Ohio State and what Oregon did to them, which were blowout victories. So Penn State wants to be in that category of teams that handle business against bad opponents. And they didn't do it against Bowling Green earlier in the season. So I think Penn State still remembers that, you know, if they want to be an elite program, you have to blow out teams that you're supposed to blow out. A 17-7 win is not a good look for Penn State in this game. What I'm looking for is for Penn State to try to generate some explosive plays through the air in this game. I think the first half, they're going to do their normal offense, long possessions ending in touchdowns. Second half, I think they need to open up the playbook and work on some things. And I think that can lead to a couple explosive touchdowns. So James Franklin, take care of us this week. We know you know the spread. We know you try to cover the spread. Give us Penn State minus 28.5 against an inferior opponent.
I'm going with the Nittany Lions also. I think that you're right. I think James Franklin will want to run up the score. I think we'll see something that we haven't been seeing much of, which is some quick strike touchdowns. Instead of these methodical 6, 7, 8 minute drives, we'll see some quick touchdowns. Maybe we'll see a defensive touchdown. Maybe we'll see a kickoff or punt return. But I do think the Nittany Lions will put up points in this one, and I'm going with Penn State also. All right, next up is Tennessee at Georgia. And I'm going to go back to last week's game when Georgia was at Ole Miss. Now, we both unfortunately took Georgia, but Georgia at Ole Miss. Georgia was only a 2.5-point favorite in this one. Now, I know Georgia is now at home. And maybe you could say, you know, that 3-point home advantage, home versus away, it's total of 6 points difference. So it's approximately the same kind of spread now with Georgia being a 10-point favorite at home against Tennessee. But it just seems, especially after Georgia lost to Ole Miss, a 1-loss top 10 Tennessee team is a double-digit underdog at Georgia.
I'm surprised by this line. So, you know, maybe Vegas is trying to tell us that Georgia is a lot better than their Ole Miss performance. The issue I have, though, is that Tennessee quietly has one of the best defenses in the country. Early on, it was all about this Tennessee offense and how many points they could put up. That switched to how good this defense is. So in a what I think is going to be a defensive game, I'm going to take the underdog on this one, who's a double-digit underdog. I think it stays close for four quarters. I'm going with Tennessee plus 10 on the road.
Okay, this is the one where I'm going with Georgia. And stick with me on this logic a little bit. I'm being illogical. I'm actually taking last week's game and that loss against Mississippi as saying, you know what, I'm not going to use that as my determining factor. I'm actually going the other way and can't see back-to-back poor performances from Georgia. Just can't see it. I think there's just too much talent there. It's too good a team, too much of pedigree of winning. And the fact is, they cannot lose to Tennessee. They can't. Three losses. I know there will be people who are saying they have quality wins. Look at the wins, not at the losses. I'm sorry. That's not how the playoff committee works. Three losses, I think, is going to eliminate you. Georgia has to win. I think I don't want to use the expression run up the score, but I could see like a, you know, 27-13, 30-14 kind of game this one. I'm going with Georgia. All right, next up, another crazy spread here. Kansas at BYU. This is 3-6 Kansas at 9-0 BYU. BYU is just a 3-point favorite here, Sean.
Yeah, I'll say it right away. I disagree with this one. Kansas is coming off that huge win over Iowa State, and I really do think BYU probably could have lost to Utah. They're back at home. I think they tighten up the screws for this game because they know playoff implications are on the line here. I don't think BYU messes around. I'm taking BYU minus 3 at home.
And, you know, I think sometimes these spreads tell us something. You know, what do they know that we don't? And I can see people looking at this as possibly an upset special. But if it were a much larger spread, I'd look at that and maybe go with the Jayhawks. I just can't do it. BYU, I know they've escaped a few games. I know they escaped last week. I'm still going with BYU also. All right, next up, LSU at Florida. LSU, speaking of three lost teams, they are a 4.5-point favorite over Florida. And I don't know if this spread is LSU kind of a letdown at this point. Nothing left to play for. I'm not sure why. I would have thought the spread would have been bigger than that. LSU is coming off of back-to-back losses. How do you see this one, Sean?
Initially, I wanted to take Florida here to keep things close and keep this game interesting, but four quarters is a lot of football, and LSU's a better team. I think eventually they wear Florida down. A 7-point victory here wouldn't surprise me at all. That's enough to cover the spread, so give me LSU on the road.
You know what? I looked at this the same way. I think bottom line is LSU is a good team, and Florida is just running through that gauntlet right now. And I think this is just – it's tough for them week to week to week, and it takes a physical toll on you. I'm going with LSU in this one also. All right. Some great picks, I think, here, Sean. Good luck to you on the picks. Good luck to me also. Hopefully we'll have another big week. That is it for our show. Make sure you join us next time on the Keystone Kickoff Show. Every day is a great day to join us at Cafe 210 West to enjoy our daily drink specials. Mondays, it's the Cafe Tea Pitcher for $5. Tuesday, Smirnoff Pitchers for $7. Wednesday, Bacardi Pitchers are $7. And Thursdays, enjoy Cafe Tea Pitchers for $5. All week, we have half-off draft beer and cafe tea from 9 to 11 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Fridays. So get the gang together and come on down to Cafe 210.